Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In his new book, Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth, Craig Childs makes clear that ours is not a stable planet. It's prone to sudden, violent natural disasters and extremes of climate. Alternate futures, many not so pretty, are constantly waiting in the wings. And Childs refutes the idea, though, of an apocalyptic end to the Earth. He finds clues to its more inevitable end in some of the most physically challenging places on the globe. He travels from the deserts of Chile, the driest in the world, to the genetic wasteland of central Iowa, to the site of the drowned land bridge of the Bering Sea, and covering the micro cataclysms that predict the macro, forthcoming ice ages, supervolcanoes, the conclusion of planetary life cycles. And in these travels, he looks to the past look forward to the prophetic future, the possible ends of the Earth. Craig Childs is a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Men's Journal, and Orion, and other publications, and he's won many writing awards. Craig Childs will be coming to Utah as part of the Utah Humanities Book Festival in conjunction with the King's English Bookshop. That appearance is on Saturday at the Salt Lake City Public Library. And Craig Childs, welcome to Access Utah.
Hi, thanks.
Welcome. We appreciate you taking some time to be with us for the hour.
Oh, yeah,
I noticed you're traveling a lot around the West with this book tour.
I am. That's my my home world, which strangely I don't get out of that often. I prefer to stay within the bounds of the Southwest and just leave when I have to, when I've got a story to write out there.
You live now in Colorado?
Right, in western Colorado.
You grew up in New Mexico, I believe.
Oh, Arizona, Colorado.
Arizona?
My family's
okay.
From New Mexico. Just hither and yon out there.
And you write in your introduction, very interesting, one of the genesis for this book, a visit you had with your aunt. She apparently thought a lot about the end of the world.
Right. She was writing a book about how to survive the end times, I was at the time traveling a lot in the wilderness, and she said, well, you're going to be one of those who survive, and I wasn't sure what to think about that. I just came back saying, well, what is it that I am supposed to survive, and do I even want to survive whatever this is?
So you've thought a lot about what it would mean to be there at the end of the world, so-called, to survive it.
Yeah, I used to think about it in a very tangible sense. What would happen if civilization fell? What would happen if everything changed all of a sudden? So in this book, I'm setting off to answer the question of well, what is it? What would the end mean?
And you write in your introduction, we maybe were asking the wrong questions.
Right, because I believe we look at endings as being these final moments that come all at once. I to some degree wrote this book to dispel the notion that apocalypse is a moment, is something that comes on a certain date, and say rather that is this continuous process, something that is always happening, that the Earth is tenuous. It has many different equilibriums that it could head toward, and they don't. You don't just head there all at once. Very rarely in Earth's history has there been a moment that just changes everything instantly. Even asteroid impacts turn out to be a little bit more of a mosaic than an instant death.
So you, in essence, with these travels, you're traveling back in time to look to the future.
Right. I'm looking over 4.5 billion years of Earth history, and just looking for the moments when everything changed, and how long those moments took, and what kind of recovery there was, and so I'm taking that and looking at us now, saying, okay, what's our context? Where do we lie within this idea of shifting worlds, and what is our role in it?
Wonder if I could have you read a page and a half here.
Yeah, sure.
This is in the introduction, Roman numeral 14, and maybe have you start the first full paragraph, which begins about 10 seconds into it. You're writing about an earthquake that you experienced. You were traveling. You were in a third floor, I believe, sleeping on the couch, and then this violent earthquake begins. And you say that you went, as we're all taught to do, to the door.
Yeah. And then I looked back into the living room where I'd been sleeping on the couch, and that seemed to be where the action was. All the books were shaking off the shelves. This was the Northridge earthquake in 94, and so it was a really violent quake, not the biggest one, but one of the swiftest. And about 10 seconds into it, the euphoria wore off. I must have instinctively known the tensile strength of concrete, reinforced with tied rebar, and we were near the limit. I remember thinking, if this goes on for about 5 more seconds, this building is coming down. At that moment, the shaking subsided. The tectonic rumble echoed away. I stood slack-jawed, amazed. Car alarms must have been going off everywhere, but to my ear, there was nothing but unbreakable silence. The world was again still.
And then the power came back on, but you saw in the distance dust rising from the mountains. You say that was a key moment for you.
Yeah, because I was watching the television, and they were showing, you know, helicopter coverage of the damage all around the city and the overpasses that had collapsed, and then all of a sudden the Santa Monica Mountains just went hazy, and I thought, oh, that it must be an aftershock, and then I heard the sound of that impact from the Santa Monica Mountains. I heard it growing louder and louder, so I could actually hear the wave moving through the crust of the earth, and then it hit the apartment, and the apartment just shook, and for some reason that just burned it into my mind that the interconnectedness of things, that wow, we're all in this together. We're all on this surface that you know, you strike one spot and you can just hear it rumbling across to where you are.
And you say this event lifted a veil for you. In fact, you, before you begin the introduction, talk about the word apocalypse. Of course, it's in the title of the book. It has a couple of meanings. The original meaning was not the one we have now.
Yeah, the original meaning from Greek, apocalypsis, is not about catastrophe. It's about lifting of veils and seeing what is underneath, about revealing the mysteries. And so apocalypse, you know, I'm treating it both ways in this book as a radical change, because, you know, really any kind of change that happens quickly on the earth and on a global scale can be or is destructive. It you know, not everybody survives, not every species. Things change dramatically, but I'm also looking at it with this earlier definition of mine in mind, that these landscapes, these places that tell the story of endings, they reveal how this planet works. This book really is about the evolution of the Earth and what kind of planet we live on.
So to get these clues, it seems like it requires you to go to some of the most extreme places on Earth.
Yeah, I'm looking for places that reflect various endings. I'm looking for a landscape that I can say, okay, if X and Y happen, then the Earth will look like this, and I go to the Atacama Desert in South America, or it will look like this. I go to get airdropped onto the Greenland ice sheet, and so I'm telling the stories from the actual place, because You know, I want to take the reader along on a journey and say, okay, well, you may have an idea of what you think apocalypse is, but let me take you out there in person and show you how, you know, how you move through it and what it tastes like, what it feels like. I really want to give a visceral sense of an apocalypse.
And we'll travel with you to a few of these places, have you read some more from the book. Craig Childs, by the way, is our guest. He is author most recently of Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. And he'll be appearing at the Salt Lake City Public Library on Saturday, 3:30 in the afternoon. That's sponsored by the Utah Humanities Book Festival with the King's English Bookshop. You're welcome to join the conversation here if you would like at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or upraxcess at gmail.com is our email, upraxcess at gmail.com. By the way, I don't detect any here, but I just wanted to ask you, for you, are there any religious overtones whatsoever here? Many people, when they think apocalypse, end of the world, for them, it's their religious overtones.
You know, I don't really detect religious overtones. It may be coming out of me from a Christian upbringing and the Book of Revelations and so on and so forth. You know, that always burns something into your mind. But maybe I'm countering that idea. Maybe I'm going against the idea of Armageddon and sudden destruction in a way. I wrote this to be an anti-apocalypse book, to change the way we think about apocalypse, because I you know, there is that Revelations notion of you know, the trumpets blast, the clouds part, and fire comes raining down. And yes, that does happen, but not, you know, it tends not to happen everywhere at all at once. It tends to be more about places and times. And so I don't think that I have much in the religious overtone in this book.
And one of the points that you make is that the end of the world, if we could call it that, is unlikely to be sudden. It's over time, and it's evolution. It's changes over time.
Right. And you know, how fast those changes come determines whether we call it catastrophe or not. They tend to take a long time to play out. You know, we're talking now about climate change, global warming, melting ice, rising sea levels, and we're thinking in decades, because, you know, we're concerned for our immediate future, our immediate economic future in a lot of ways, and I'm saying, well, you know, decades are very fickle. It's hard to get a fix on what's going on if you're just looking at decades. The changes that we're seeing now are going to be magnified in centuries and over thousands of years. And I guess it was a struggle for me in this book. I really want to be conveying this idea that thousands of years from now really matters, even millions of years from now, even though that kind of future may seem completely out of our grasp. We are pushing the buttons right now that create the world that will exist in centuries or in thousands of years. So it's a much slower process than we think. There can certainly be moments where it spikes, you know, where a hurricane makes landfall at high tide and the sea level's already up. That, you know, that makes it very sudden for people.
Hmm. One of the, I'm sure, one of the arguments which will rage, not only with your book, but other science that's being done, and you've probably heard this in regard to your book, is the whole debate over climate change. And on the one hand, you're saying that these are natural cycles and over hundreds and thousands of years, and that perhaps would play into climate change skeptics' hands.
Right. That is a concern of mine in this book, because I do come away having met with many scientists, having sat with one of the lead authors for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in a tent on the Greenland ice sheet for weeks, talking about these issues, I come away very aware of how things are changing. That we are in a moment of very significant change. Is rare in the geologic record of the Earth. This is a moment that really stands out over billions of years. And on one hand, I'm saying, sure, there are cycles that are going on. These climate changes are very normal. The Earth has seen far worse than what we're seeing right now, but we have not seen far worse. The species that are alive on the Earth right now, for the most part, have not seen far worse. So it's, you can say, sure, it's natural. Climate change is natural. So is dying in a car accident. That's something that happens every day, yet we try to avoid dying in car accidents. And I think that we can also try to avoid creating a catastrophic climate scenario, which I believe we are setting ourselves up for and are well on our way into.
Which we as humans are contributing to, causing?
Right. It's, there's really, after having interviewed so many people, and including skeptics, and taking skeptics very seriously and saying, asking, where they're coming from, what the idea behind this is, I come away going, how can you believe that humans do not affect the course of the Earth when we make these wholesale landscape changes? When we change the chemical balance of the air, when we occupy so much of the Earth, and I guess in this book I'm trying to say let's just take this for what it really is. Let's take out the emotional component, the political component, and just look around and see that we have changed everything around us. And then for us to say, oh, we don't actually affect the Earth, we don't affect climates. It's kind of ridiculous to think about it that way, because obviously we do. We affect everything. And one of the stories I'm trying to get across in this book is to say there are many, many forcing mechanisms that influence the Earth, and we are one. And in fact, right now we appear to be one of the major components changing how the Earth works.
We're talking with Craig Childs, who's author most recently of Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. He's going to be giving a reading at the Salt Lake City Public Library. That's on Saturday, 3:30 p.m., sponsored by the Utah Humanities Book Festival with the King's English Bookshop. We'll take a brief break here. When we come back, I'm going to ask Craig Childs about the sixth mass extinction. He says scientists are saying that is underway. Five times before, life has winked out, as Craig Childs puts it. A sixth mass extinction underway. More with Craig Childs following this break.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by the law firm of Hilliard Anderson & Olson, with offices in the Riverwoods Business Complex at 600 South Main. Concentrated practice areas include estate planning, trusts, wills, and probate. Information is online at hao-law.com.
I'm Victor Hawkstrom, General Manager of Utah Public Radio. Thank you for the progress you've allowed us to make over the last fiscal year. Because of your commitment and feedback, we've improved our national and statewide programming and have promptly responded to technical problems. We've enhanced our Utah news coverage with correspondents throughout the state and now directly serve your community with specific programs, news, and specials. We will continue to work to remain your favorite public radio station for all the programs you enjoy, as we look forward to a long-lasting friendship. Thanks for your support.
It's Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest for the hour is Craig Childs, author of Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. In the book, he says, ours is not a stable planet. It's prone to sudden, violent natural disasters and extremes of climate. And he refutes, however, the idea of an apocalyptic end to the world. finds clues to its more inevitable end in some of the most physically challenging places on the globe. We'll get some of those adventures from the Atacama in Chile to, this was surprising, Timmy Craig Childs, you went to a cornfield in Iowa. We'll talk about that as well. I wanted to talk about the sixth mass extinction. You say that five previous mass extinctions, scientists say there is a sixth underway.
Right. If you look back through Earth's history, extinctions are going on all the time. Species are constantly overturning. Either they're disappearing altogether, or they're becoming different species and leaving the old one behind. And there are these moments where the extinctions come all at once. Up to 70 to 90% of all living things on Earth disappear. And usually it's not swift. There's still a lot of debate about the extinction around dinosaurs 65 million years ago, but it looks like it takes tens or hundreds of thousands of years to play out. But they're definitely there. They show up in the record where just the majority of life just stops. And it appears that we are entering into the sixth mass extinction in Earth's history right now, based on how many species are vanishing, how many are threatened, because if you're looking at time, if you're looking at more than just the next few decades, the loss of habitat and the threat to species inevitably leads to extinction, and so the numbers are high, hard to get an exact fix on it, because we don't even know how many species are around, but we know enough that are disappearing that we can project out and realize that this is one of those moments in Earth's history where species are vanishing at an unprecedented rate, and it appears that we are in the sixth mass extinction.
What will this mean for us?
It's really hard to tell what it'll mean. I think it's something that you won't necessarily see, because humans, we live in isolation in a way on this planet. We as long as we have apple trees and house pets and sparrows around, we'll think that the world is fine, and we won't see that there's this just massive loss. And I think it's I'm sure there are all kinds of ramifications directly from species loss. I mean, for instance, pollination and bees. The systems start to fall apart because species don't exist on their own. They're part of a larger network, a support network that we live within. But I think what it means also is that it is an indicator of major change. And that's something to pay attention to. When things start really changing around you, when species levels are dropping dramatically, that's the time to look up and say, well, where are we? What kind of planet is this? How does this work? What happens when species disappear? Because that's an indicator of a substantial change that's happening on the planet. And if you live on this ball, if there's a substantial change, no matter who you are, it's going to affect you.
I want you to take me into the desert. This is a couple of these are extreme places that you go, have to do with some of the driest places on Earth. You went to the Sonoran Desert in Mexico, the Atacama in Chile. I believe you say that's the driest place on Earth. Maybe paint the picture for me. You take your field notebook, put on a backpack, and what you head out.
Right. I load up as much water as I can and just head into the desert. That's what I always do. I am here to go on journeys and to understand the breadth of landscapes. And for instance, in Sonora, Mexico, I was backpacking across a few thousand square miles of sand, of dunes blown in from the Sea of Cortez across the desert. And there, a friend of mine and I, a friend from Moab, we would go down and load up all the water we could and carry it out into the dunes and then just drop it out there, set up a cache, and then return and get another 100 pounds each, load it up and take it out until we have just as much water as we can get deep into the desert. And once we have that, then we can start base camping and exploring and getting a sense of what that place is made of.
You say deserts are tricksters. What do you mean?
Well, they grow and they shrink. Desert edges are really undefined. Changes to the land cover, you know, removing plants can cause deserts to grow. Excuse me. Changes in climates can cause, you know, the edges to expand. If you look at South Africa right now and the Namib Desert, the dunes are starting to unfurl. There are dunes that have been held down by grasslands for a long time, and those grasses are disappearing, which is allowing the sand to mobilize. So the projections are that there will be almost a southern Sahara Desert forming across Africa as the desert grows out. But it's kind of, these are chaos equations. They're really hard to predict to see exactly how the desert is going to work. But we can see around the world that atmospheric recirculation coming off the equator and dropping down dry up higher and lower on the globe creates deserts, and that pattern is getting bigger. Those circulation patterns have extended by 2 or 3 degrees of latitude just over the last few decades, which is really significant because these atmospheric patterns are desert makers. And so basically, if you want to see what your future is probably going to be like in a place, look 2 or 3 degrees of latitude south. And you'll see that landscape moving up toward us over time.
You say that, I was reading this, you're quoting a study from 2007, United Nations brought experts together. Droughts are at record highs, and if we continue at current levels of temperature, aridity, and consumption, desertification will directly cause uprooting of at least 50 million people.
Right, and that's if things just go as planned. That's if we stay on a level playing field, everything keeps going the way it is. But I'm also looking back through time, back through the last 10,000 years, and seeing these events called mega droughts that are lasting 50 years, or that have lasted 50 years in the past. And right now we're dealing with 7-year droughts, 10-year droughts. You know, even talking to a water manager who's running half of the water for Phoenix, Arizona, he was saying, we just don't have models for the kind of droughts we're seeing right now. And then I'm looking back through history and seeing that, wow, there have been some huge droughts that kind of blow everything away that we're imagining. And they are completely possible, even without human pushed climate change. There's the potential that these numbers we're talking about now are very low.
Hmm. You also write about reaction to advancing deserts, planting trees in China, planting grasses in India.
Yeah. I think at the same time that you can say humans are causing catastrophes, humans are also interacting with the land in a very different way. You know, we are managing soils and planting trees and planting windbreaks and starting to understand how deserts work and how they spread and you know, there are ways of slowing them down, of changing their patterns, because we do have an influence. I look at friends who are living outside of Tucson in the desert who've just taken out shovels and kind of bermed their property a little bit, and their water table is rising. So just, you know, while everything around them is dropping. So, you know, there are ways of affecting this earth one way or the other, good or bad. We are doing it.
I wonder, parenthetically, that must be legal, I guess, but there have been laws against that sort of thing. I know in Utah there's a big controversy a few years ago about, you know, water barrels up on your roof.
Yeah, because you know, Western water law is immensely complex, and if you are retaining water on your property, that means as in rainwater, that means you're preventing that water from entering the watershed. So it gets tricky. But you know, the people in Tucson I mentioned, they aren't actually they're not retaining any water. I mean, they're not putting up stock tanks or anything. They're just changing how it flows across the land, and you know, they're causing it to linger in places long enough that some of it percolates down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, imagine anybody living in the Western U.S., especially Southwest, would respond to your chapters out in the deserts. Could you tell me a bit about, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, Orans in India?
Yeah, these are forests in India, especially in the arid regions. They're really important. They are just protected areas, and often with some religious or ceremonial aspect, but they're kept the way they are. While the desert is growing around them, these natural areas are retained, and they end up being genetic refuges for whatever can grow out of the Oran into the surrounding desert. So they are these refuges that are, you know, maintaining the future, maintaining the possibility that even as climate change gets underway, you know, dries things out, allows deserts to spread, there are these last places that are being held onto, so that when it rains next, when the weather turns, which it always does, the climate never just goes one direction, their seeds will be blowing out of these orans and blowing back into the desert, and you will get grasses and you will get trees. So you know, these are ways in which we hold on to the world we have now.
But it could be decades, couldn't it, before the climate changes again? This is sort of a Noah's Ark of hope.
Right. And that's something I'm trying to bring up throughout this book, is saying, well, these little arcs are what actually saves the world, and always has. You look at the past mass extinctions, and you look for those arcs. You look for refuges where species survived, and those become the source for the future of the planet. So I think this arc idea is a very intrinsic concept for the Earth. It's how things work here. I was looking at lava flows in Hawaii and succession of plants that come in on top of, you know, what was molten rock, you know, that completely wiped out the life that was there. And I see plants returning from these little islands that are called kapukas. They're forests that the lava went around. So you'd have like this acre of trees out in the middle of just utter molten desolation. And from those trees, spiders come out and put webs in the lava, and then ferns start growing and ohia bushes start growing. So these trees are the sources. They're exactly as you put it. They're the arcs.
Before we take another break, by the way, we're talking to Craig Childs, who is author of Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. He says that ours is not a stable planet. It's prone to sudden, violent natural disasters and extremes of climate, but probably won't be an apocalyptic end to the Earth as we think of it. This more inevitable end is found in clues in the past, and he's gone out to 9 extreme places on Earth. So before we take the break, I wonder if I could have you read a passage from the last chapter. This is on page 314. And
yeah.
It's a riveting account. This last chapter is your trip through the Atacama. I think this is the second to last chapter. Maybe starting with just that passage in the middle of the page in the Atacama, and then read over to the middle of the next page.
Okay.
With the dead cow there.
Yeah. In the Atacama, I saw the future. When the sun eats up the last of its hydrogen and burns into its red giant phase, big enough to cook life and clouds and oceans off this naked orb, It wouldn't be a fast process, not by our standards. Millions of years in the execution, our sky would finally be half-filled by a sun the color of a red-hot moonrise. After that, the sun would probably collapse into a white dwarf, meanwhile blasting away its outer shells of gas into an explosive planetary nebula. I imagine that all of our minerals will pay off as we make a rainbow streak flaring off into space. We will be beautiful. Even today's bright, thumb-sized, main-sequence sun, middle-aged and burning nicely, seemed a little much. In the midst of its crisp light, I swear I could hear, or perhaps feel on my shoulders, a torrential rain of neutrinos. Our route took us into zinc-white junk heaps of broken salt plates, complete chaos, sun beaming up inside of our nostrils. It wasn't good walking, no trail, no clear path. The ground seemed bombed out. It's surprisingly similar to walking through lava, JT said, more of a complaint than a comment. I said, yeah, I thought it was going to be more of a salt flat, you know, flat. It was like walking through a coral reef. Ages of water flows and snowmelt floods from the volcanoes had sculpted the salar. When it dried, it contracted and buckled into table-sized pieces of hard ground hitched up all around us. The hardness was a function of salt content, mixed with lake bottom sediment, forming a concrete as weirdly shaped as stag antlers. Our aim, for the sake of navigation across the salar, was a mountain, a notch in a mountain, a strong V on the horizon about 30 miles across this jumped-up mess of salt. The only thing out of place was a dead cow. We spotted it probably an eighth of a mile out, though for the preceding few minutes it had looked like some kind of fallen ghost, something we weren't sure was there or not.
And then your friend JT, I guess, curls up next to the dead cow and takes a nap.
Right, that's his thing. Whenever we drop, he closes his eyes.
And it takes a nap. And later on, just a magical moment, out in this, one of the driest places on Earth, you see flamingos.
Yeah, pink flamingos. Their flyway is down the Atacama Desert, and there are these water sources that appear out in the middle of the salar, and they're extremely saline, much saltier than seawater. But brine shrimp live there, and so the pink flamingos come flying in, and they are straining brine shrimp, and it's almost too much to bear as you're walking across this just total desolation, and you look up and see pink flamingos flying overhead. It's just insane.
Yeah, it must be especially impactful in the middle of that desert.
Yes.
We're talking with Craig Childs, author of Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth, and we'll go to what Craig Childs calls the genetic wasteland of central Iowa when we come back from a brief break.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by USU's Department of Environment and Society presenting the energy documentary Switch, tomorrow at 7 p.m. in the Eccles Science and Learning Center. Information is at cnr.usu.edu/envs.
I'm Victor Hawkstrom, General Manager, Utah Public Radio. To all of our kind and caring members, thank you for your pledge of support during our fall pledge drive. Because of you, Utah Public Radio has been here since 1953. But we need to continue this tradition of public radio excellence and can only do so through your compassionate, helpful, and kind support. Our fall pledge drive has been very slow going. We're significantly behind our goal. With your caring and kind support, we can reach our $90,000 goal. So if you are not a member or have not yet renewed your much-needed membership support, please share your generosity by pledging today to assure the continuation of the excellent programs you enjoy on UPR. Call now or go to upr.org. Thank you for your thoughtful consideration.
I'm Tom Williams. You're listening to Access Utah. Thanks for joining me today. We're spending the hour with Craig Childs, who is a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. His work has appeared in New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and various magazines. He's won various awards for his writing. His latest book is Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. Craig Childs will be at the Salt Lake City Public Library 3:30 in the afternoon on Saturday, for an appearance sponsored by the Utah Humanities Book Festival with the King's English Bookshop. You're welcome to join the conversation by email at upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com, or the number 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, about 10 minutes left in this conversation. Craig Childs, we do have an email. This is from Steve in Beaver Dam, Arizona. He says, your conversation brings to mind the late paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould's observation about scale and time. Quoting Gould here, in the long run, that is tens or hundreds of millions of years, said Gould, the planet will return to an equilibrium that is beyond the capacity of humans to change. But we humans don't inhabit such a span of time. And in our own scale, we are doing significant damage to the planet's environment, which Gould observed is a very bad thing to do.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of what I'm writing about here is time. I really think this is a book about time and the scales involved, where I'm saying the same thing, that you look at a mass extinction and then, you know, 5 to 10 million years later, the Earth recovers. It goes back to original levels of biodiversity. And you can say that about the Earth right now. You can say, oh, it's going to be fine. We aren't going to destroy the planet, but we are going to destroy the planet that we know, or we could destroy the planet that we know. You got to think in both time frames, which is what I'm trying to do with this book, say there are these multi-million, tens of million year, or even billion year patterns to the Earth, but then there's the length of our lives. They're the species that we know. There's the environment that we see around us. There's this just incredible garden time that we live in right now and we've been in for 10,000 years, which is fragile. You know, we think of it as everything because it's all that we know. It's where humans rose up to be who we are, but that it can change. And that's very dramatic for us here now.
One of the things you say you set out to do was think about what it would mean to be there at the end of the world, and of course we've talked about what that means. Part of it is our responsibility, as we've been talking about, but other must be a sense of wonder.
Oh yeah, I think even for me, more than anything, this is a book of amazement where I'm recognizing what actually happens on this planet, how this thing works, how big it is, how complex it is, and yeah, there are the warnings and the call to action to say, you know, we do want to hold on to the world the way it is now because this is incredible, and these other options, these other faces that the Earth has shown in the past are, you know, not that great for life and for people like us. There are some really trying times out there, and I personally think that we need to be fighting hard to prevent that from happening, to kind of hold on to this incredible time we have. But at the same time, I'm backing away and looking at the big picture and just saying, wow, this story is just vast, and We are part of it. We are one of the elements in it. We play a role in this big future of the Earth.
And you talk about how many of these process, many of these scenarios would be gradual, be evolutionary, but mm-hmm. it's possible to there be a sudden end. For example, a huge asteroid hitting the Earth, or a super eruption, the Yellowstone volcano erupting suddenly. You talk about I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, La Garita.
Yeah.
Caldera in Colorado, 70-mile wide hole with something spectacular must have happened there.
Yeah, it's the biggest known explosion in Earth's history, and it's just this big hole. I mean, it's 28 million years old, 28 to 30 million years old, so you don't, you know, right now it's this beautiful mountainous area with forests and rivers, and you don't see it until you back away, until you look at it from space, until you walk it with geologists, and you see this just enormous explosion. You know, we talk about the Yellowstone supervolcano and what might happen if that thing goes off and changes the world. Well, you look at the La Garita caldera in Colorado, and within it there are numerous Yellowstone volcanoes that that exploded afterwards, but were inside of the caldera, you know, that were essentially mini eruptions. And so if you were around at that time, anywhere nearby, it would have blanketed North America, and it seems to be part of a larger climate change that was happening 28, 30 million years ago that seems to have been driven by supervolcanic eruptions. You know, these things do happen, and if it happened now, it would change the picture dramatically. We would not be talking about anthropogenic climate change anymore. We would be talking about a very different kind of climate change.
That would change the conversation, that's for
right,
sure.
Right. Right, yeah. Now we're the star of the show. Mm-hmm. We're doing all the big action. We're changing the chemistry. But there are powers out there that can easily take it way over the top, far past what we're doing.
We just have about 4 minutes left, and I want to talk about Iowa. I did not expect to have you in the middle of a cornfield in this book.
Yeah, I don't think I expected it either.
What are you talking about with that chapter?
You know, I was looking around the world for the best analog landscape, you know, the best mirror of a mass extinction, of just a major event where most of the things living in a place are gone, and that only one or two species remain to dominate. And, you know, I looked all around the world at different sites, looking at Lake Chad, looking at the Aral Sea in Central Asia, and I finally realized, oh, the best mass extinction landscape I can find is in Iowa, where 90% of the state is under agricultural production. And you know, just say, okay, well, on the ground, this is what it looks like. It was tall grass prairie, and now it is monoculture. And two of us took backpacks at the height of July, which is just an awful time to be out there. Oh, my gosh, it's just so hot and humid, especially when you're from the West. It blew me away, and we backpacked for 3 days through these shoulder width rows, just carrying our water and moving ahead in these eternal lines, where I was saying, well, this is a mass extinction, this is what it looks like. Everything that was here before, gone. What's here now? Corn.
And you quote Edmund O. Wilson. He says, I'm paraphrasing, that this through the destruction of habitat, this loss of biodiversity, that's what our descendants will be least likely to forgive us of.
Yeah, and E. O. Wilson is just a brilliant researcher and theorist scholar on matters of mass extinction. And he's looking at it and saying, you know, this is the biggest thing that's happening on this planet. This is the biggest impact that we can see, and it's very human driven, because the what causes the main cause of extinction is habitat fragmentation and destruction, and the introduction of competitive non-native species, and those two things, you know, we are the ones doing those. We are the ones breaking up habitats and erasing them and carrying species around the world with us and reintroducing them in new places. So, you know, you can tie that directly to human impact. It's what we are doing right now.
But through this this huge endeavor, aren't we feeding many more people?
Yeah, we're feeding more people, but then you have to ask the question, what exactly is the goal here? Because the number keeps going up. Yeah, we're feeding more people more and more, so there can be more and more. And you know, where are we heading with that? You know, we were at 4 billion not long ago. We're at 7 billion now. Where does this go? Is our object simply to fill the planet with as many people as possible? That doesn't seem like a great plan. It seems like there are other options, and so I'm asking that question out there. You know, I don't want this world to collapse. I don't want human extinction to happen. I don't want human desolation to happen at all. I have children. I have two little boys, and I look at them and say, okay, well, I don't want you dying in an apocalypse. I don't want this thing to come to an end. I want something beautiful and sustainable, and you know, going up to 10 billion to 15 billion to who knows what, I don't think that's going to lead to a good life on Earth for very many people.
We'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. We've been talking with Craig Childs, author most recently of Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. Craig Childs will be in Salt Lake City on Saturday, 3:30 in the afternoon at the Salt Lake City Public Library. The visit sponsored by the Utah Humanities Book Festival with the King's English Bookshop. Craig Childs, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah. By the way, tomorrow we're going to have a debate on Cache County's RAPS tax, the arts and parks and zoos tax. It's up for renewal. Voters will have a say on that, and we'll be debating pros and cons tomorrow on the program. Hope you join us.